I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm sitting on a bench by the side of a little stream. There are bluebells and there was a huge bee, but I kept it cool. I faced it down. We had a sort of diplomatic moment and the bee has now gone off to hopefully eat someone else's face. My guest this week is the author Miranda Ward. I was very lucky to read a proof copy of Miranda's incredible memoir, Adrift, Field Notes from Almost Motherhood at the end of last year, and it completely blew me away. The book covers the 5 years Miranda spent trying to get and stay pregnant. The book is funny and poignant and incredibly honest, but also clever and thoughtful. It feels like a really considered book about a subject that lots of us feel clumsy or unqualified or uncomfortable talking about. Since Adrift came out in January, I've bought 4 copies for different friends who are in the midst of their panic years. It's my sort of go-to response now. If I hear that someone's having trouble conceiving or staying pregnant, I buy them a copy of Miranda's book and I send it to them. And so thank you, Miranda, for helping me out in what is sometimes a time when you feel quite impotent and helpless. Miranda actually lives around the corner from me and brought me wine and biscuits the day my book came out, which is very nice and gives you a measure of the sort of person we're talking to. Miranda spoke to me about her miscarriages, about the way she felt around pregnant people when she herself was trying for a baby, and the sheer messy reality of losing a pregnancy. Obviously, this is a warning if you are in a place where you don't feel comfortable or ready or sort of able to listen to that kind of thing. I completely understand, but I do think it's really important that this is something that we talk about in the same way that we talk about relationships and our bodies and housing and all of those things, because it is such an everyday reality for millions of people. Also, please stick around after the interview on that note, because our expert guest this week is the brilliant Sophie, a midwife for the NHS, and who's also a Tommy's midwife. Tommy's is the pregnancy loss charity, and Sophie just gave me a really informed explanation of what a miscarriage is that I think is really helpful for anyone. You know, the chances are you will know someone who's had one, and the more we all understand about that, the better we can support each other. So enjoy my chat with Miranda, and I'll be back in a little bit. How are you, and how is your body?
I am very well. I'm very caffeinated. my body is tired. I feel very well physically. I'm sort of, after a long period of not knowing myself and being pregnant and then being postpartum, I sort of feel like I have ownership of my body again for the first time in a long time. So I'm good.
Adrift is just an amazing book, and the book that I wish had existed in my 20s, because I think it would have just informed me and educated me in a very heartfelt, lived way what it would mean to say, I want to have a baby, and for that not to happen immediately. Your experience is that from the moment when you and your partner thought that you might like to have a baby, there was how many years after that of being in and out of pregnant?
We'd been talking vaguely about it for quite some time, but I think it was around 2013 that we sort of said, okay, well, I'm going to come off the pill and we'll see what happens. And that very ambitious, carefree way that you can approach things when you're young and kind of don't know better. Then for the next 6 years, really, we tried to get pregnant, didn't get pregnant, got pregnant, miscarried, had fertility treatment of various kinds. I gave birth to my son earlier this year. So that's, you know, basically a sort of 7-year period between making that decision and committing to it and actually having a result, if you can call him a result.
One of the things that is boggling to me is that you are still only just into your 30s. You were quite young when...
Yeah, wrote, very young.
So he was 31 and you were 26 when you decided, which...
Yeah.
I, at 28, had this sort of major life change that I'm now pinpointing as the beginning of my panic years. Do you think that came earlier for you, or do you think your it was those subsequent 7 years that felt like the decision-making time?
Yeah, I was very young when I met my partner. I was 20. He was 25. He was meant to be a one-night stand. like, we met in a bar, and somehow that just ended up being, you know, this really wonderful intimate relationship that we're 13 years into now. But I was sort of taken aback by that. and also by the conviction that I felt quite early on in our relationship, because I'd never really, obviously I was so young, I'd never really thought beyond the kind of passing idea of having children about whether I wanted them, what it would mean. I just assumed I did, but it was a very abstract notion and, you know, always assumed I was just nowhere near ready. But relatively early on in my relationship with my partner, it just kind of occurred to me that actually, yeah, I'd quite like to have a family with this person at some point. To some extent, the fact that he's a bit older than me, and obviously, you know, 5 years now doesn't seem like much, but when you're 20 and he's 25, that's a reasonably significant kind of gap.
That's an entire degree.
Exactly. And so I think he probably had been, you know, he's perhaps had started thinking about it more seriously. It became clear that we both have this similar future in mind, and that I think because we both had a sense of directionlessness in other aspects of our life, particularly around our careers, both of us, I think actually in a sense having a child became like a tangible thing that we felt that we could do. I think I came at my panic years sort of obliquely and perhaps from a different question or point than you did, but the end result was the same, which is that actually I then, you know, we decided to have a child, great. Then spent the next 6 or 7 years seemingly sort of stuck at that point. And everyone else around us, it felt like, were, you know, they were moving forward with their lives, they were getting promotions, they were buying houses, they were getting married, they were having babies, they were like real proper adults. And I still didn't really know what I was doing with my life, what I was kind of aiming for. We didn't, and we were, you know, we don't own a house, we didn't have savings, we're not particularly financially responsible. So really, the panic years was this big swirl going on in the backdrop, and this one single question and this focus became a focal point that seemed like something we could do or have that we knew we wanted.
The next step after having that conversation, what actually happened?
We had that conversation. We're sitting at a pub and we just kind of decide to go for it. And I, you know, I throw away my pack of pills. And at the beginning, it really just seemed like, we'll see what happens. You know, I was young, I was 26. I had no underlying health problems to my knowledge, no reason to think that I would have any difficulty particularly conceiving. So we spent a few months, you know, doing what they advise, which is having sex as often as possible. It was going on a year, I think, and nothing had happened. And so I made an appointment with the doctor to talk about perhaps being referred to a clinic so they could do some tests. And as if somebody was scripting my life, I had this appointment booked with the GP to discuss the referral to the fertility clinic. And the day before the appointment, I realized that my period was late and that I had a few other symptoms, and I took a pregnancy test and I was pregnant. Yay! And of course, what happened after that is that I miscarried at about somewhere between 7 and 8 weeks. And then I had another miscarriage about a year and a half after that. Then a few months after that, I had an ectopic pregnancy, which is a pregnancy that forms outside of your uterus. So in my case, it was in my left fallopian tube, and they're never viable. So usually or often the treatment is surgery. So in my case, they actually just removed the entire fallopian tube because they didn't want to risk leaving any pregnancy tissue there, which meant that it doesn't halve your chances of getting pregnant, but it does reduce your chances of getting pregnant naturally because you only have one fallopian tube. At which point they kind of told me that if we didn't conceive within 2 years from that point, I would be eligible for a round of NHS-funded IVF. So we had this sort of 2 year period where we just thought again, okay, well, we'll wait and see what happens. And I didn't conceive in that time. So then we did a round of IVF, which resulted in a pregnancy that I lost at 12 weeks. And then we did another round.
It's quite exhausting even just to list it like that. I think one of the things that I find so frustrating and upsetting is that until I was in my 20s, occasionally, like a boss or someone that I considered more senior to me or older than me would lose a baby or lose a pregnancy. And then you'd hear like, oh, she lost it. She's lost it. I didn't know what that meant. My biology GCSE had not taught me, like, I think you said the first time it happened, you were 8 weeks pregnant. So you hadn't had a scan yet. How did you actually know that you were having a miscarriage?
I had, until it happened to me, absolutely no idea what it meant to have a miscarriage. And like you, I'd kind of heard, you know, I knew I had acquaintances, I had a couple of friends that I knew had had them, but we hadn't really talked about it. And to some extent, you know, there's no reason that you would know that much about it if you're, you know, you're in your early 20s, you're not kind of in the thick of the baby years. But I just had this very abstract notion of what it meant. And I think what I thought was that you had, you know, this very intense period of pain and bleeding, and then it was done.
I just thought you got a supersonic period, and then it'd be like, oh, that's just like shit.
Exactly. And so what happened to me was that I was kind of, yeah, I guess it was between sort of 7 and 8 weeks, somewhere in that region. I was on the bus coming back from a meeting with my PhD supervisor in London, and I felt that I was bleeding
into the coach seat.
Into the coach seat, not actually bleeding heavily enough to seep in, thankfully. But but I got home and checked, and I was indeed bleeding, not hugely substantially, but enough that it worried me. So I phoned the GP the next day, and they kind of took me in, and they said, "Well, you know, there's no way to tell unless we do a scan." They couldn't schedule me for a scan for a couple of days, so the bleeding stopped at that point, but I was obviously completely terrified that something was wrong or had gone wrong, but didn't know. So I kind of, you know, just went to meetings, went to the grocery store, whatever it is you do.
Did you?
Yeah.
You can't wear a badge that says I might be miscarrying.
Exactly. And we hadn't really told anybody apart from, we told our parents because we were planning to get married at that point, and my due date was like a few days or a week or two before our planned wedding date. So we kind of had to tell our families that actually we might have to put the wedding on hold.
We're going to have a 2-day shotgun wedding.
Yeah. Well, but we hadn't told anyone else. So there was, you know, I couldn't easily at that point then just sort of jimmy it into the conversation. So the scan showed that there was an embryo. It was in the right place, but there was no heartbeat.
Right.
But all of the pregnancy tissue, all of the products of conception remained in my womb. So the bleeding was not itself kind of me expelling anything. And what happened then, and I think this partly happened because I just was so ill prepared for what this could look like, what it could be, is that they said, okay, well, you have a few options. You can wait and see what happens and, you know, hope that it just passes naturally with time. You can take the medical intervention route where they give you a medication and drugs in the hospital, and then you go home and you expel the products of conception at home, or you can take the surgical route.
Isn't it wild that those three options I didn't know about genuinely until I was 29 and it happened to a friend?
I had no, and it was like the doctor very, very kindly explained this to me. She gave me a leaflet that outlined everything, and I went home and I was hysterical, not with sadness, although I was very sad, but I was so terrified about the fact that actually this wasn't a straightforward process and it wasn't just going to resolve itself. And in all likelihood, I was going to have to make a decision about having some kind of intervention. But I couldn't make that decision. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just see what happens. I'll just see what happens. And I think I waited like a month and nothing happened. Mm. And I just had this really bizarre month of my life where I was continuing to do things. I went, you know, to seminars, to meetings with my PhD supervisor.
Wow. Okay.
Did all of the normal everyday things that I would normally be doing, just with this kind of thing hanging over me. And I was terrified about, particularly about the surgery. I'd never had any kind of surgery. And I finally did decide to go down that route because I just couldn't live day to day anymore with this thing inside me, and I wanted to move on. But I just hadn't had any idea that that was what happened or what could happen. And of course, the thing is that every single miscarriage is different. So, you know, before all of this, I'd heard, oh, she had a miscarriage. And I just pictured this kind of, as you say, this supersonic period, you know, and then bam, it's done. And you've lost the baby and it's terrible and it's sad, but that's it. And I just hadn't thought about the messiness of it. And I don't just mean the kind of physical messiness, but the emotional messiness and the ambiguity of it.
The ambiguity, I think the idea of carrying something around in your body that is a sort of a lost potential, for want of a better word, is a really strange idea. Did you feel at any point sort of odd, but queasy, weird, grossed out?
Yeah, I had a sense of sort of geographical dissonance from myself where I couldn't quite reconcile the idea that my body was my body, and yet also this thing was happening inside of it that was invisible. There was nothing I could do about any of it. And that was the thing that I found very, very challenging, was that I couldn't control the outcome. I couldn't control what had happened in the first place. There was nothing I had done that had caused it. There was no point of blame, which would have been horrible, but in some ways easier if somebody had said, oh, it's happened because of this. And that isn't how miscarriage works, generally speaking.
Well, and it sounds like that's not what happened all the way through this 6-year process. All along that, you were apparently a healthy, fertile couple that could have had a baby, and yet you just weren't having one.
Yeah. And there were certain things that were kind of picked up on at various points. So I have what's called a bicornuate uterus, which is, it's sort of heart-shaped. So rather than one big thing, it's got kind of two sections to it.
What a very quaint name.
I know.
I've got an emoji for a uterus.
Every medical professional that's ever examined me has been greatly interested in the shape of my womb and has gone, oh, do you know that? And yes, I do know. But it doesn't, it itself doesn't actually necessarily impede conception. It doesn't cause miscarriage. Little things like that were picked up on because I was being examined so kind of regularly. But
you've just made me think that there is a weird thing that most people with wombs don't know anything about them until someone else examines it for you. And I remember feeling that sort of disgusting year five, I've got top of the maths class sense of like pleasure when I had my first coil fitted and they said, you've got a perfectly shaped uterus. And I was like, oh, thank you. But it's so weird that you have all of these, especially as someone who identifies as a woman and has been raised as a woman, you have all of these judgments about your body, and so much of it is a sort of external signifier, the size of your boobs, your bum, what your face looks like, all that stuff. But the thing in the middle of you that may well play a huge part of your life is completely mysterious for decades. And for, you know, before scanning technology, would have been mysterious your entire life. I find that so weird.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't know anything about miscarriage before I had a miscarriage. I also really didn't know that much about like the logistics of conception and pregnancy until I had a pregnancy and lost one. I mean, I was pregnant and I still like didn't quite understand things that I now have a much clearer picture of.
Yeah, it's insane. It's like being told your whole life, well, one, you know, when you are the ship's captain, but you've never been allowed to go on a boat. Like you don't know what happens on there. You're just told that at one point you're going to step on board and you're going to have to charter it to Australia. The side of a sort of Tampax packet is about all you get about ovulation and fertility and conception, and it's actually so it's much more complicated and harder and more unlikely than you're ever led to believe.
Yeah,
the description of your ectopic pregnancy in the book is very dramatic. Did it feel sort of dramatic at the time?
It was, I think, probably one of the most bizarre experiences of my life, because I didn't know I was pregnant until I started to bleed what I thought was midway through a normal cycle. And I phoned the doctors and they sort of said, well, you know, have you taken a pregnancy test? And I said, well, I can't be pregnant. I just had my period. And they said, well, take one anyway. And it was positive. But of course, that meant that, you know, for the first time since we'd started trying to conceive, I had a positive pregnancy test, and it wasn't a good thing because already something was wrong. And then there followed this sort of 2-week period that was just totally bizarre. Everyone knew something was wrong, but nobody quite knew what. And it was kind of, okay, wait and see what happens. Then what happened is that finally I did have a scan. And at that point, it was fairly clear to me what was happening. And I think fairly clear to the doctors. They were being very careful. Because the problem with ectopic pregnancies is that eventually they can rupture. And that's extremely dangerous. It's life-threatening. I had pain at times, quite distinct, odd pain, but I otherwise felt fine. And I was like, I was going into work. I was working in an office at this point.
My God.
I really was just going about my daily life. I went to a Hindu. I just carried on.
God, the idea of you like drinking out of a penis-shaped straw with what feels like a sort of, it's like the film Speed, that you're the bus. Like at some point, this is going to possibly be very dangerous. It's going to explode.
It was very hard to hold that awareness in my head, but also have people kind of saying, well, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. It was clear at that point that something was not progressing correctly, but it could have also just been a miscarriage. I mean, this is the way I had to adjust suddenly to kind of hoping that I was miscarrying rather than having an ectopic pregnancy. But they eventually did the scan, and they could see a sort of bulge. They call it a sort of bagel-shaped bulge in my tube. My uterus was empty. So they were able to say definitively, okay, this is what's going on. And then suddenly, after all these weeks of not knowing, I was scheduled for surgery later that afternoon. They gave me my own private room. They were very, very fast moving. But what happened after that is that I had this sort of reconciliation with my body. So I talked about this sense of dissonance that I experienced with my first miscarriage and also with my second, where I just really, I felt this kind of rift between myself and my body. And I don't believe there's this distinct kind of self and body division, but that is how I started to feel. And I mistrusted my own body. I blamed it for what was happening and what wasn't happening. And then I had this experience where actually, bizarrely, the ectopic pregnancy made me remember that I wasn't just this kind of, as I've said, this baby-making machine. Like, I felt very kind of protective of my own self and my own body first and foremost. And I felt weirdly kind of very good in the aftermath of that. I mean, I felt shocked. And I think in some ways I didn't deal with it as I should have immediately. It took me a lot longer to kind of emotionally come to terms with it. But one weirdly positive thing that came out of it was a sense of ownership of my own body again, and a sense of caring about me and myself, rather than wanting to just blindly give my body to this task of trying to create a baby. And that, I think, was really important.
And the fact that you were now lopsided internally, just had your one tube, how did you feel about that?
I did sometimes sort of sit there and think, this is really weird. I'm missing an internal organ that I didn't even, like, I didn't feel my tube before. It's not as if I had an intense awareness of its existence, but it's just not there anymore. And of course, what that means is that, you know, it was already seemingly unlikely that I was going to fall pregnant naturally, but now it's even less likely. But it's, all this sort of weird, invisible stuff going on inside your body that you don't really have a clear map of.
And at this time, I think it's around this time in the book, you write this brilliant thing that I think really doesn't get talked about enough, which is your completely understandable and completely unjustifiable hatred and resentment towards mothers.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant. That you would just see someone having a picnic with their baby or like feeding their baby in a cafe and just think, fuck you.
Totally.
Sorry, we're not allowed to say it. And you just think, how dare you?
And I mean, that was one of the things I really, really loved about the panic years was you described that particular kind of jealousy towards particularly friends, close friends, when you learn somebody's pregnant and you love them, but you also kind of hate them at the same time because they have this thing that you want and it's going to change your relationship with them. And of course, what was happening to me was that I was well now into this trying to get pregnant thing. And I had all these friends who were just starting out on the journey, and all of a sudden they were pregnant, and it seemed so easy. And it was really hard for me not to resent them, even though I was also, in another bit of my brain, very happy. And I became quite an ugly person in a lot of ways, because I hated my friends who were having babies or who had babies and for whom it seemed easy, even if it wasn't, because you never know. I hated random people I would see on the street who were visibly pregnant. You know, I hated mothers. As you say, I would, you know, sit in the pub or the cafe doing some work, and I would see them clustered around the table with their babies, and they were just talking about babies, babies, babies. And I couldn't bear it. It made me so angry. And I knew it was irrational, and I knew that it had to do with my own feelings about myself and my worry about whether or not I would ever have a baby myself. But I couldn't help it. And it's just one of those things that happens.
In writing the book, I was sort of confronted by the fact that fertility issues and miscarriage, probably as the most common of those, is as great a hallmark of the panic years as dating, struggles to find a job, housing. You know, it will come up for a lot of people around you and possibly you yourself. And yet navigating that is really hard because we don't necessarily have the ritual or understanding about how to do it. When someone loses a job, we kind of know what to do. When someone breaks up with someone, most of us know what to do. When someone gets engaged, we know what to do. But when someone has a miscarriage, we're all a little bit inept, or I certainly felt like I was inept. And it's going to, for most people in their panic years, that's going to happen to someone around them. Do you ever think about the things that you wish you had known or that other people had known at the time?
It's tricky because everybody responds differently to that experience when or if it happens to them. And there are some people who really don't want to talk about it, or who kind of find it quite painful to dissect. I was not one of those people. I really wanted to talk about it, but I didn't know how to. And so I was always waiting for people to ask me about it. And I think there was a certain point where I realized that wasn't necessarily going to happen and that I was going to have to bring it up. But it took me a long time to get there. And when I did get there, I suddenly discovered that actually there is this whole world of people who know what it's like. Or if they don't know what it's like, can still offer you support. But they can't see that it's happening unless you tell them. There were things that people said to me that I found particularly unhelpful. The sort of most notable of which is one that I think people throw around a lot. And some people might find this helpful, but I just couldn't stand it. And it's at least. So, oh, I'm sorry that happened, but at least now you know you can get pregnant. At least you're young. Which are both very valid points. You know, the first time I had a miscarriage, it was relieving that I knew I could get pregnant because I'd been trying for what felt like a very long time at that point. But that doesn't counterbalance the experience of losing a pregnancy. Likewise, youth. I mean, it, you know, yes, that's true that in some ways I was very fortunate that I started this process early enough that my age was never particularly a factor or a barrier. But again, that fact in itself doesn't counter the grief or the loss or the anxiety that you experience. And I think people are tempted towards those kinds of statements because they want to offer consolation. It comes from a good place. And as I say, there may be people for whom those thoughts are very helpful. For me, it just felt like it was underlining my own failure. You know, well, I can get pregnant, so why can't I stay pregnant? Well, I'm young, so why can't, you know, why am I not able to do this? And of course, it also felt as if it was trying to minimize the experience by sort of saying, well, you know, it's not that bad. You'll just get pregnant again, right?
We're so quick to say there's a silver lining, there's an upside mm-hmm. to this, there's a benefit yeah. to this. And sometimes the more kind thing is to say to someone, that is shit.
Yeah.
Talking of understanding and compassion, I realized that you talked about how there was another miscarriage that was quite a different experience to that first one. And I wonder how, what changed?
Yeah, so that was the third miscarriage I had, which was, it was after the ectopic pregnancy as well. So I'd had, at this point, two miscarriages and an ectopic pregnancy. And this pregnancy was a result of IVF. So we did around a cycle of IVF, which takes some time and is itself quite a physically and emotionally draining process. And the end of that process, after you've kind of submitted your body, and I found it a weirdly comforting thing, because I'd spent so long trying to get pregnant through, you know, this kind of the magic of nature. And actually, it was just really comforting to have somebody like intervene on my behalf and try to make my body do what it was supposed to do. And it worked. It was lovely. It was hard to trust that things would go well. It was hard to trust my body, but I began to as time went on. And I reached a point finally where I was further than I'd ever got before. And we told a few people about it because friends knew we were going through IVF. So I had certain friends that I would kind of talk to about it. And it became a thing that I felt a lot more hopeful about than perhaps I had previously. And then we got to just before the 12-week mark, I started to bleed. And I had, by this point, had the experience of my second miscarriage where, in fact, I started to bleed and then they saw a heartbeat. And then ultimately, a few days later, there was no heartbeat. I had this kind of like, okay, bleeding in and of itself doesn't mean that I'm going to lose this baby. And they scanned me and they said, oh, look, everything's fine. Here's your baby. I never had that image that you see on social media, the scan with the recognizable little baby there. It was incredible to see that. And it was fine. So wait and see what happens, but hopefully the bleeding will tail off and this will be nothing. And that does happen. So that day, everything looked okay, but I was still bleeding. My husband and I went and bought a car that afternoon because it was like a form of mania. We didn't know what to do with ourselves. We had this, on the one hand, intensely hopeful, wonderful thing. We'd seen our baby on the screen with the heartbeat. It looked like all the scan images that, you know, you see that kind of precede a live birth. And on the other hand, I was bleeding and we had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. I mean, we needed a new car. Our car was really on its last legs, but that's not the time to impulsively buy a car.
It's also such a sweet role playing of like, what do parents look like? They drive a car.
Yeah. We drove to Aylesbury to buy this car. The bleeding as we were driving was getting, I could feel more and more intense. And we, at a certain point, I kind of realized that I'd bled through onto the seat of our car. And we had to stop at this big Tesco so I could go and like buy super pads and new leggings. And then I didn't want to take my coat off in the new car in case I, you know, before we bought it, in case I bled on the seat. And all of this is happening. And it's like, well, on the one hand, something might be terribly, terribly wrong. And on the other hand, I still have to hold in my head the possibility that everything's fine, because that's what I saw earlier today. And over the next day or two, I started to develop some cramping, which I didn't think anything of at the beginning. And then at a certain point, realized that it was probably not a great sign. But nevertheless, we had this appointment for a scan. So we got, you know, taken into the room. They did the scan. There's no heartbeat. But there was, you know, still everything was there, just not growing anymore. And the next day was Mothering Sunday. You really couldn't make this up. I mean, honestly, if I wrote that in a novel, I feel like an editor would be like, no, that's a step too far. You can't, you're really over-egging it. But it really, yeah.
This is ITV3.
It really was Mothering Sunday. And I, now having been through labor, can it say that it was an experience akin to labor, dialed down significantly, but the cramping, the rhythmic cramping, the intensification of it, to the point where I phoned the hospital and said, I don't think I can stand the pain anymore. And they said, knowing full well what was happening, they said, well, have you tried a hot water bottle? And I said, no, I haven't actually. Thank you. And in fact, the hot water bottle did help for a bit. But I did eventually, I went to the loo and I passed the product of conception. This is perhaps graphic and way too much information. I caught it in a kind of little bed of loo roll. And then I called down to my husband and said, can you bring a Tupperware up, please? Because the hospital, the doctor at the hospital had said, we can test the material. There are certain tests we can run, diagnostic tests, which might be helpful.
What did it look like?
It just looked like a little sack of jelly. I mean, it was like the whole sort of sack was, you couldn't really see, I couldn't see this, and I didn't look that closely because at a certain point I realized how totally bizarre this situation was. And we put it in a Tupperware, and then I phoned the hospital and said, this has happened. What do I do with it? Should I put it in the fridge? The nurse said, actually, if you can bear to, that would be really helpful. Yes. Oh. But the thing about this is that it was in the moment, this very intensely painful experience, both physically and emotionally. But I also felt this immediate relief. I mean, as soon as I'd passed this thing out, I felt physically fine.
Wow. So, yeah. What did you do with the Tupperware? Did
they keep it? I mean, the doctor, everyone is just so nice about things. And also, like, it's just totally bizarre.
Even the nurse saying, if you can bear to keeping it in the fridge, like, that is so thoughtful.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a remarkable thing to have gone through. The obvious question to me as a writer is, at what point did you think, I'm ready, or I can, or the thing I want to do now is to communicate this experience?
It was all I could think about and all I could kind of think to write about. But also because I really wanted to capture what that felt like, because what I wanted to read was not the kind of conventional, I had these experiences, it was horrible, but look, here's my baby now, everything's fine. Or conversely, I had all these experiences, it was horrible, I never did have a baby, but I
walked the Appalachian
Trail.
Exactly,
yeah. Found myself and did these amazing things. And I have a lot of trouble with this narrative that you can either be a mother or something really important, that you can't, you can't be a mother and climb Mount Everest, and also that you can't not be a mother, but also, you know, not spend that time you would spend mothering doing something extraordinary. Like, can we not just be people doing things?
Absolutely.
And so I was very conscious of not wanting to write that narrative to the extent that I felt I couldn't wait until I knew what was going to happen to start writing it, because I would lose that.
Mm. And what shines off the page is that uncertainty.
Well, and that's the thing that I had to realize, was that actually all of those years where it felt like we'd put everything on hold, like, we were still living our lives, my husband and I. We were having meaningful experiences, doing things, forming wonderful friendships and relationships, and kind of working on our relationship with our own parents and our own families. But I had failed for a long time to see it, and this loops really nicely back to the anxieties of the panic years, to see it in any terms other than we're falling behind. We haven't achieved what we're supposed to have achieved, or what we set out to achieve, and therefore we just have to stay here, we're stuck, we can't kind of, I don't know, we can't move on or do anything. And of course, what I didn't see is that is, like, that's most of everyone's life, is just waiting around, doing nothing, you know, it's...
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've always been interested in is this idea of, you know, what characterizes places and how people form relationships to places. And what I wanted to do here was set up this time in my life as a place and write about it as if it were a place, and not a kind of climbing mountains or looking at grandiose places, but like places like waiting rooms and swimming pools and really mundane areas of our lives that we spend most of our time in, but often overlook. And I think there's the analogy there is to these phases of our lives, like the panic years, where you have to inhabit that space. And if we start to map it and describe it as a place, it becomes easier or clearer somehow to see it and value it.
So beautiful. Think of it as a sort of travel memoir of a place that was unremarkable and yet significant. The life that's lived out in waiting rooms, changing rooms, cars, people's front rooms is as significant as when they travel abroad and overseas and to places that look significantly different to their home. Thank you so much to Miranda. I was only sorry that because we recorded that interview deep in lockdown, we were both sitting in our own houses, two streets away from each other, rather than together on the sofa. After reading Miranda's book, I was struck that even me, a very open, hopefully engaged woman, I didn't really understand what miscarriages actually entailed until I was probably in my late 20s and people around me started to have them. Honestly, I don't know if I really understood the process of a miscarriage until I read Miranda's book. So I wanted to speak to an expert guest about what miscarriage means, how common they are, how they're managed, and how we can best support people experiencing them. Tommy's is a charity that researches the causes of pregnancy and baby loss, provides support and information for people who have lost or are losing a pregnancy, and campaigns on how to make pregnancy safer. I spoke to one of their brilliant midwives, Sophie, about what a miscarriage is and how we can better look after people who are having them. Here's a question. How common are miscarriages? I know it's hard to tell because often people don't know that they're pregnant when they miscarry and it might look like another period or whatever, but roughly speaking.
Unfortunately, much more common than we would A, like, and B, like to think. So one in four pregnancies at the moment is the information that we have. So one in four pregnancies we think end in pregnancy loss, especially when, you know, when you take into consideration that some women might have a chemical pregnancy. So a chemical pregnancy could be between sort of 3 and 5 weeks. It's something that we don't always know about, and probably for some, gratefully so, they would rather almost not know. So it's very difficult to know the exact figures, but we believe it's one in four pregnancies.
What actually is a miscarriage and when does it occur?
Miscarriage can occur a few different times in a pregnancy. So there is such thing as an early pregnancy loss, an early miscarriage, which happens before 12 weeks gestation. And then there is late miscarriage, which happens after 12 weeks gestation, but before 24 weeks gestation. So obviously there is a huge difference in what kind of symptoms you might get with those different types of miscarriage at different gestations. And there would also be different potential, what we call management ways to manage the miscarriage. So there would be potentially three different ways to manage a miscarriage in those situations, all obviously very difficult to go through regardless of what type and what gestation. A miscarriage is where a pregnant person experiences potentially some bleeding, some cramping, sometimes a mixture of both. Missed miscarriage would be classified as when a woman goes for a scan, thinking maybe she's potentially, 8 or 9 weeks pregnant, and potentially she's unfortunately not as many weeks far along as she once thought because the pregnancy has stopped growing. So there's a few different types of miscarriage and they all have their various technical terms. But ultimately, you know, what matters is that women get the right care at the right time for the right gestation.
Yes. So let's talk about the care, because this is something that I really didn't understand until it started happening to people around me. If you are experiencing a miscarriage, what do you have to do from that point?
So what in the first case scenario, what I would say is if someone is pregnant and they're experiencing cramping or they're experiencing bleeding, whether that's just, you know, sorry to be graphic, but just on wiping themselves, mm-hmm. Or whether that's just, you know, they have seen blood in the toilet or they're physically bleeding. The first thing to do would be if they have contact with a local NHS early pregnancy unit. Some women, you know where that is. They know the numbers, you know, call them, be seen, go to them, be, you know, get yourself reviewed. Alternatively, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there is urgent care centres, minor A&E units that will also see you. So, you know, everything always seems to happen at 3 a.m. on a Sunday, you know, and ultimately people need to know where to get help. Mm. You can either, you know, go in person to your A&E minors unit and be seen, or, you know, some people call 111, hello, I'm pregnant, I'm bleeding, I don't know what to do, where do I need to go? And therefore they will be advised where they can go. You would likely to be seen by an obstetric or gynecology doctor and potentially an early pregnancy nurse, right. Potentially be scanned to see whether the pregnancy is progressing or sadly not. Mm-hmm. Some people will be offered something called a HCG blood test. HCG is the hormone that's present in our bodies when we're pregnant, and we expect it to astronomically increase in numbers. So in the first few days of pregnancy, the number will be very low, and over the days and weeks, it will really really shoot up from, you know, from the single figures up to, you know, 10 figures. You
right,
know?
Okay.
So the HCG level of a blood test will give us an indication as to whether a pregnancy is ongoing and doing what we expect it to do, or whether it's a static number and actually we're expecting it sadly to go down again, which would signify, you know, a loss of a pregnancy.
And so once it's been established that the pregnancy is not progressing as hoped or as expected, can you just explain to people what actually will happen to you then? Like, what do you need to do? This was amazingly news to me, that if you're having a miscarriage, you won't just bleed out necessarily. Like, there will have to be some kind of intervention.
So in terms of what to expect, quite often if another scan is needed, so sometimes they'll say, we're not quite sure what's going on, we will invite you back in 1 week or 2 weeks to confirm this. And people can find that 1 to 2 week wait understandably very difficult. But obviously when we're talking about growth of such a small organism, such a small being, that the period of time of a week or 2 weeks is huge in terms of development. So sometimes it's a case of, we're not sure whether this pregnancy is developing or not, therefore we need to invite you back in 2 weeks to confirm that this is sadly the case, or it might be more obvious than that in more simplified cases. What they can then expect is to kind of be offered three kind of choices, and they're never choices that anybody wants to make. The first option usually is kind of a watch and wait. So we call that expectant management of miscarriage. Uh-huh. So usually we'll, you know, send a woman or a couple away and say, look, you can expect to maybe start to bleed in a couple of days, a couple of weeks. If this hasn't happened, please come back to us, you know, whether that's the early pregnancy unit or A&E. The second thing that they might be talked through is medical management. So they'd be given a tablet or two that might take place in the hospital, or that might take place where you're given the tablet in the hospital and then you're sent home and given a helpline number to call if things become scary or worrying and you need to check up, you know, what's going on. And that tablet will help the body to kind of start miscarrying naturally. So it gives it a little bit of extra support, because sometimes the body doesn't kind of know what it needs to do, so it might not naturally start to bleed.
Right.
So that tablet encourages blood loss, so it encourages then the pregnancy to pass. And then the third option is what we call surgical management of miscarriage. So that's whereby obviously the pregnancy is removed surgically. And there's a couple of different ways that is, you know, offered. And it will depend on the gestation of the pregnancy. For some people, it can be their third management they've tried. They might have tried the natural management, nothing happened. They might have tried then taking the tablets, that hasn't actually, you know, helped either, and therefore they've needed to then have the surgical procedure done. Of course, if you've got something in your uterus that's been there for a little while, we need to consider that it's a potential source of infection risk and potential sepsis, especially when you're talking, you know, weeks that this could be going on for. We need to be cautious that, you know, women and their partners are aware of what signs of sepsis looks like, so they can advocate for their own health.
It's such a good point that actually your health is something that you might not be thinking about in that moment, but it's really important.
Yes.
That as a pregnant person that you are sort of made aware of the risks and processes that you have to kind of go through. I think there are a lot of people like me who get into their late 20s, 30s, maybe even into their 40s, who have never had a detailed, open discussion with people about miscarriage, and they might not realise that the people around them are having miscarriages. But if the rate is 1 in 4, do you think we should be talking about this more? Is this something that should be a sort of, you know, should we be discussing this in the same way we talk about kitchens and cars and weddings? Like, is it, if it's that common, is it something we should all be sharing a bit more?
I'm biased because I'm a midwife, but I absolutely think yes. You know, I often say to women that call the helpline, you know, if you were to, and I'm not advocating anybody does this, but if you were to send a text to everybody in your phone to say, I've just had a miscarriage, I'm feeling a bit on my own with this, have any of you had one before? You would get so many messages back saying, yes, I have, or yes, my sister has, or my cousin, or my friend. You know, this is something that historically maybe people have felt they had to suffer alone in silence. So I'm a Tommy's midwife and I'm an NHS midwife. And part of what I do at Tommy's is getting involved in our health campaigns. And one of our health campaigns a couple of years ago was Always Ask. And another one was, you know, Break the Silence. So we're trying to break the silence on miscarriage. And we called it our Miscourage campaign. So having the courage to speak out about miscarriage and knowing that, my goodness, you are not alone. And it is a much higher number than any of us want it to be. And we are working on bringing it down through research and care. But ultimately, you're not on your own with this. And there is a lot of support and a lot of help available. Miscarriage is such an emotive topic. You know, women and couples pee on a stick, they hope for a pregnancy and they see a positive line and they're like, great, I'm a mum, I'm a dad. You know, flash forward to, you know, your child's graduation, waving them off to, you know, university, whatever it is. You know, the minute you get that positive result, you can see a future. And then when somebody loses a pregnancy, loses a baby, it's such a difficult thing to go through. And we as midwives completely get that because we live it day in, day out, and we support couples. But for the general public who aren't in that field, it can be a real shock and they can feel very much alone. So yes, like, absolutely reach out to people, tell your nearest and dearest that you're pregnant as early as you want to, because ultimately that's support, isn't it? You know, and if something terrible does happen and sadly you do have a miscarriage, those people are there to support you and to surround you in a bubble of love and to make things feel a little bit better. So, you know, in our opinion, yes, talk about miscarriage more, talk about, you know, how you're feeling more, and ultimately you're going to get A, better care from healthcare professionals, and B, you're going to get better support from, you know, your loved ones around you. So it's just, I can't recommend it enough. Just talk. Talking makes everything better.
Hello, welcome back. Nice to see you again. Thank you for listening right to the end. Thank you, of course, to Miranda Ward and Sophie at Tommy's for talking to me this week. Thank you to my producer, Rich Jarman, for making the podcast with me. But most of all, thank you to you for listening. Next week's guest is the brilliant comedian, actor, author, star of Ghosts and Statlet's Flats, and author of a brilliant new book called Delicacy, Katie Wicks. We discussed cake, work, the panic years, and moving to London. So please come back next week for that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and you know what, even if you haven't, please just subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. Like cleaning under your nails with another nail, it's free to do and will make you feel brilliant. Goodbye.
This is a brand new audio production.